Hello and welcome to the Locked On Cavaliers podcast, your daily look at LeBron James and the rest of the always interesting Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm Chris Manning, your host from FearTheSword.com. Today's show is Mike Zavgano from Fear the Sword and the Cavalytics podcast. We're talking about Game 3, adjustments both teams have made, what Kevin Love and George Hill have done to make an impact on the series, the potential of Jedi Osman and Jose Calderon playing in Game 4 and beyond, and a little bit more on this series and looking a bit ahead as well. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes, subscribe, leave a 5-star rating and review. That is the best way to support the show. But without further ado, here is today's show with Mike Zavgano, who you can find on Twitter at mzavgano11.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, Mike, let's start with LeBron game winners. You were at Game 3. I was not. I was coming back from a work trip and needed to get some sleep, basically. But you were there live for that. I was there live for the one he hit in the Pacers series over Thad Young. I don't know if that was like your first LeBron game winner, and obviously you've seen them live, you've seen them on television before, but was that your first one live? And just what was the reaction to that shot? Because when I found out about it, I had taken the night like completely off, seen my phone before I went to bed and did some editing, but basically like saw the clip after the fact and just was, there's like 9 things out of that I picked out of that I just couldn't believe. And then he did almost the same exact celebration he did after the Pacers series. But what was experiencing that LeBron shot like in arena?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I mean, you know, I was kind of, more than kind of, I was really upset after OG hit the 3. I mean, you could just see that Jeff Green completely and totally screwed up the defense on that play. And so I was like really pissed off about that. I was just generally kind of upset about the defense in the entire fourth quarter. And so like it took me a minute to refocus and like, okay, they go into the timeout, and you know, I was sitting there and I was trying to like be positive. And then I, you know, I turned over to my mom. I was at the game with my parents, and I was like, Mom, you have to record this possession, you know, just in case. And then I was kind of shocked that they took the ball out full court, as opposed to, you know, moving it up to the half court. And once LeBron kind of got going downhill to his left, it was almost like you just thought that he was going to make the shot at this point. I mean, he's just done it so much and so frequently, and everything that he's come up with this postseason has basically been complete and total gold. So as soon as he let it go, you just kind of figured that it was going in. And once it went in and the place went nuts, and, you know, Richard Jefferson was standing next to me, and I looked over at him and he looked at me and he just kind of shook his head and smiled. And I was like, you know what else can you say at this point?
Hilarious that Richard Jefferson, who was on the Nuggets last year, obviously left Cleveland in weird circumstances. It's pretty funny that he's just back kind of chilling at practice, how much fun he's having with this. I'm very envious. Like I was a little salty that I wasn't there and took the night off to like have a life for a second. But I am just amazed at how demoralizing that was. Like my almost favorite part of that, seeing the clip, was just how the Raptors reacted. In particular, Jonas Valanciunas, for the second game in a row, had just an incredulous look on his face when LeBron did something that was just gutting, and he freaked out. Serge Ibaka just standing there like, what am I supposed to do? And then you get the windy oral history of that shot, which I'm not sure if you've read, but there's the whole thing that at Scoops Marone on Twitter pointed out was the trapping issue with the Raptors. Just that whole thing is just, yeah, a debacle for Toronto. Like, that was a very good shot for them to win that game. They survived that Korver burst in the second half. They survived that Love bit in the second half, and then they get that 3 on the possession before, and then LeBron just goes full god mode and ends up like, that's just gutting for them to go down 3-0 that way. And then all the people that have set the turn the 0-2 into the 0-3 clip from God's Plan and set it to that clip, I love you. And it's just like, it's just everything for them is just has to be gutting right now.
Yeah, when I was watching that possession back, you know, both just after the game, but then also when I was studying the film today, you know, I was thinking about that Casey quote after the game where he said that they wanted to double team, or, you know, they had thought about trapping. And there were two distinct opportunities there where I thought that they could have easily trap LeBron if that was their plan. You know, first, right when he caught the ball out of the inbounds, I thought Siakam could have gone and trapped. And then, you know, Kevin Love kind of set a token screen. He didn't actually, you know, screen off Ananobi, but he brought himself close enough to the ball in the backcourt where Siakam could have absolutely trapped again. And it just didn't even seem to be something that was on his mind. And so it just, with that context, it felt weird that Casey said that after the game, that they had thought about trapping, because nothing about the actual possession indicated that to be true. And yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, when I was walking out of the arena, I was just thinking about Sean Woodley and Blake Murphy, and, you know, having gone on Locked On Raptors during the day yesterday. And you know, I was just thinking about how tough it must be for them, because I feel like Jonas Valanciunas, like you said, he's almost like the Raptors fan base personified. Every time LeBron makes a shot, with his reactions from the bench, it's just like covering his head and putting his head in his hands and all that kind of stuff. And I feel like that's basically what everybody's doing at home on their couches.
It was also, I felt bad for Raptors Twitter, and I love all the Raptors writers that I like, love talking to Twitter, and Sean and Blake and all the good folks at Raptors HQ. And John Gottes, but they had that great, they had a hive mind reaction to a certain piece that went up on a certain site that loves the Celtics, at least they had that therapy session for them after game three, because, oh man, like, if there's anything that was going to take their mind off of game three, it was that, and picking apart that story piece by piece. Coming out of game three, LeBron's obviously going to get a lot of the focus, and him, and I think there's been too much time, not by you, not by me, but people on Twitter talking about MJ and him. I think in practically the two most interesting things coming out of this game were Kevin Love having another really good game. I think he was, for me, he was better in game three than he was in game two to some degree. And then George Hill and how they've played together. Let's start with Kevin Love. What for you, Mike, has been the difference for him in these last two games, where he was bad against the Pacers for most of that series and in most facets of the game, wasn't great in game one, but has looked like Kevin Love, all-star Kevin Love, these last two games? What for you has stood out for him in how he's played?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Thad Young's gone. That certainly
Not having like a brick wall that he's trying to post up has made a huge difference.
But I mean, I do think that, you know, the Raptors, I mean, just aren't the physical team that Indiana is. I mean, they're switching way too much, in my opinion, but they're switching a lot of things. It's ending up with Love in mismatches. And, you know, I think that being able to get going against guys like Lowry, like DeRozan, like CJ Miles in the post, you know, guys that typically wouldn't be guarding Kevin Love, I think has really given him some confidence. Certainly being able to shoot some unencumbered threes against JV or Poeltl. He hasn't shot as well from three in this series as he did last series. But I think that he's just able to play a lot more free. He's actually used his left hand this series. He's, you know, thrown some left-handed passes, dribbled with it. He made a left-handed hook over CJ Miles. It seems as if he's a bit more comfortable. I don't know if he's a bit more healthy, but he's at least, I guess, gotten used to kind of what's going on with the thumb. And you just look at it, you know, against the Pacers, he posted up 27 times to finish possessions over a 7-game series. The Cavs scored 16 points on those plays. In this series, through three games, he's already posted up 28 times to finish possessions, and the Cavs have scored 39 points on those possessions. So almost 2.5 times better for the Cavs, going from basically, you know, 0.5 points per possession, which would easily be the league's worst, to close to 1.3 points per possession now in the post, which would be the league's best. And so I think we've seen a complete and total turnaround from Love down low. And I think that his decisiveness has improved as his confidence has skyrocketed.
Where this goes going forward is going to be really interesting, because when you look at how, like, we're in all likelihood not seeing Cavs Sixers now, which I think is good for him, practically, because Philly is just going to be very athletic for him, and him guarding Embiid was just obviously going to be a huge issue. You look at the Boston, a potential Boston matchup. Their starting lineup so far has been in with other injuries, and obviously this will not be the Celtics team the Cavs are going to have to deal with next year and years down the road. They're going with Rozier, Smart, Tatum, Horford, Baines. You know, assuming the Cavs stick with Love at the five, and it seems like they're going to, I wonder if Boston adjusts. I wonder if they just decide to put Horford on LeBron, or have Horford guard somebody else, or try to hide Bane somewhere. I wonder if they try to do that. I wonder how that they approach this, because Love has been this good, and when he's this good, it takes the Cavs to another level. It makes them more dangerous. It gives LeBron, it takes some of the burden off of LeBron James. There have been instances where it has just taken some of the burden off of him. In particular, in Game 7 of the Pacers series, when he had that little burst, it allowed him some minutes of rest. It's going to be huge for LeBron going forward to get that from Kevin Love. I wonder how, looking forward, I wonder if he can keep this play up, and if that left hand is good, and if he can continue to be this efficient to maybe even get back to where he was shooting from three in that first series and rebound as well as he has. I wonder how Boston game plans for this, and that's looking a tad too far ahead. I don't want to discount Toronto, and I think Love has to do this in Game 4 as well for us to have it being three games in a row. But I wonder how Boston's going to defend this, and how seriously they're going to treat the threat of Kevin Love. That's one of the, looking ahead of that series, that to me is one of the most interesting things about that series, is does Boston change their lineup at all, which has worked for them, to think about Kevin Love. Does Marcus Morris, for instance, start instead of Baines?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they would start Baines if the Cavs start Love at center. I think that Stevens has demonstrated that, you know, he's very flexible with that starting lineup. You might see Ogilvy start. I know that that was something that he employed late in that Bucks series, in terms of having Ogilvy come in, start guard Giannis, and then, you know, having Horford on whoever they played at center. I would assume that that would be the move, either Ogilvy or Morris in the starting lineup, having them take LeBron and then having Horford on Love. I mean, the opposite of that is obviously whether or not the Cavs feel like they need to go back to Tristan Thompson to deal with Al Horford. He's obviously had a ton of success in that matchup in the last two postseasons. But then, you know, you probably put Baines back on the court in that instance, and you're probably still getting a Horford-Love matchup basically no matter what, you know, if you're Boston.
And you're going to get some Thompson too. I wonder if that, you know, makes Larry Nance more playable in that series. That's like getting, because just if they go too big, does that make Nance just more have to play by virtue of minutes? But looking at the other side of this, George Hill has had a really good return to form in this comeback, this series. He's, you know, he didn't have a ton of points, you know, in the last game, but he's played 35 minutes the last 2 nights. That back injury seems to be a thing of the past. Made the 2 threes in the last game, which was really a big part of his offense there. What have you seen from him? And even though he's not necessarily getting a lot of steals or assists, but he's shooting well and everything, and he's playing a lot of minutes. What have you seen from him that, when you look at the numbers, indicates that he's been such a huge net positive? With, particularly with LeBron and whatnot, but what has made him such a huge net positive? And honestly, considering where the Cavs are at, and it's something we're going to talk about a little bit more, how vital it is that he's actually doing this, and what it means going forward for the Cavs.
Yeah, I was fairly concerned about Hill's shooting still. So those 2 threes that he made, I thought were a pretty big deal in the last game. Since he came back from that back injury, he had yet to make a jump shot before last game. So seeing those 2 threes go down, I think, was huge. He's still shooting 60% from the restricted area in those 4 games. But he's, you know, 0-4 on above the break threes, and then 2 of 3 from the corners, and has yet to attempt a mid-range. It looked to me like he was kind of tentative on the back. So like you said, it was really nice to see him get those 2 threes to go. One was really early in the game, in the first quarter there. But I mean, ultimately speaking, I think that such an underrated part of the Pacers series was the fact that the Cavs did not have a second ball handler in George Hill. It allowed the Pacers to really pressure up against the Cavs, turn them over. You know, last night I thought that, you know, Hill had a few more turnovers than normal for him. But in the first 2 games of the series, you know, the Cavs had 5 turnovers in game one and only 3 turnovers in game two. I think that Hill is a huge part of that. He almost never turns the ball over. And now when you look at it, George Hill and Kevin Love have played 267 minutes together in the regular season and the playoffs. They have a 120 offensive rating, a 107.1 defensive rating, so a 12.9 net rating in those minutes. And the samples are so small with this team that it's really hard to extrapolate as to, you know, what does it mean that George Hill and Kevin Love basically have a plus 13 net rating in 267 minutes, which would obviously lead the league. But that's all we have, really. You know, we just haven't seen enough of these guys healthy to really know what the ceiling is. But the ceiling certainly looks like it could be quite high when Hill, Love, and James are all on the floor.
Are there situations where, like, when you think about the how the Cavs are going to have to play moving forward, and let's say, like, mess around in the finals, where are the optimal times, you think, and with who, where who should be on the floor when Hill does get his rest? Let's say he's playing 35-ish minutes a night going forward. 13 minutes is not a ton of time for him to sit, but it's still, on average, a couple minutes a quarter. It's going to certainly, I think, be in the beginning of second quarters, or third quarter, somewhere in there, when he's going to get these big chunks. Who, honestly, do you think best equipped to take over? I have a theory about this, what I think the Cavs would really like it to be, but I'll talk about that, but I don't necessarily think that it's possible or not for them to have exactly what they're looking for in terms of the supplemental minutes when Hill's out because of how some guys have looked.
Yeah, I think that one thing that the Cavs still need to work on, in my opinion, is that every minute that LeBron rests, I think that both Hill and Love should be on the floor. It's gotten to the point where Love has basically been on the floor for all of those minutes, but I really think that, especially you saw at the end of the third quarter when Kevin Love went on his run yesterday, that it was in Hill and Love minutes, and they were basically able to run that 1-5 pick and roll, get Kevin Love posted up on that left block against either mismatches. A lot of the times it was against Siakam because he was guarding Hill in those minutes and Love was able to outstrength him. And I just think that having those two guys on the floor together as opposed to just Love is hugely important. And it ties in with the fact that, you know, Jordan Clarkson just doesn't pass right now. I was watching him, you know, in person, and I thought that it was even worse than it is on television because, you know, I could see his eyes when he's dribbling the ball and he doesn't look at anybody. You know, he's just looking at the rim. And it's basically like, you know, how is Jordan going to score the ball on this possession? Not, you know, how am I going to get other guys involved as a point guard? I mean, he only has a 9.6 assist percentage in the playoffs despite playing second unit point guard. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Ty Lue said he was going to play Clarkson with a point guard in the playoffs, and that certainly hasn't happened. But, you know, he just hasn't been good enough. You can say the same thing about Rodney Hood, sorry. I mean, I think that Clarkson, to me, has been a bit better defensively of late. He had made some good effort plays in game three. But, you know, on the offensive end, neither of those guys have given you anything. And it really does make you wonder as to whether Jose Calderon should get some of those minutes just as kind of a stabilizing force, or Jetty should get some of those minutes just to kind of see what he can give. But it's been a rough sledding for both Hood and Clarkson.
I really, really think that they were hoping Hood would take some of this on. I think when you look at what he was in parts of his time before that back injury at the end of the regular season, which I'd have to go back and check the box scores and run some of the numbers on this to be sure. But that to me seems like the turning point for him was when things got a little wonky. It hasn't got as much attention as Nance because I think Nance was just his high was a lot higher before that hamstring injury. But Hood not really coming back after he had that, you know, that 11-point fourth quarter at one point. They're running, frankly, some sets for him that at the beginning that were pushing Kyle Korver to the fringe a little bit. Him not being right, I think, has been a detriment to them because I think they could use that secondary creation. I think it would take some of the pressure off of LeBron. And when he talks about him, talks about him wanting to be aggressive. It was very interesting if you go back and watch his, you can find his, it's on Cavs.com, you can find his video from Sunday's practice. He talks about, you know, with Clarkson, it was like he just wants him to play hard and be engaged. And with Hill, with Hood, it's, I want him to be aggressive. I want him to go and be himself and put more emphasis on being aggressive on the offensive end while also being more physical with guys on the other end. I think they're hoping Rodney at some point could be more aggressive. And the problem is, I don't know if that's just going to be right now. And that I think brings us to the other little nugget that he dropped on Sunday, Lou did, was they're considering, they've talked about, to use his language, that they've talked about playing Calderon and playing Jetty. I get why they would play Calderon. To start with him, because he gives you ball handling. He's been dependable all year. They have that winning record with him in the lineup. Whatever. I think there's a clear issue just athletically with playing him. I think athletically Clarkson's been a mess against Toronto. I'm not sure that Calderon would be any better. I think there's no reason to believe that he would be any better. I think moving forward, he'd be a real problem against pretty much anyone he'd have to defend against Boston, not to mention Houston and Golden State. I get the value of playing him. I don't know how much it really moves the needle. I think if I was going to change anything, it would to be put more length on the floor, but that also puts more on LeBron. It's not an easy solution. It's one of the little flaws on the fringes of this guy's roster that he's sort of filled when he's needed to, but it's not a real solution. Jose Calderon is just not a real solution at this point in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things too with Hood, I don't really think that he's been in positions to succeed. You know, there's so much emphasis on running this dribble handoff play with him where he comes from, you know, essentially to his left hand, going to the left. And, you know, he was not good as a handoff player in Utah. He was not good as a handoff player during the regular season. He has not been good as a handoff player during the playoffs. I have no idea why there's some, you know, this continued emphasis on that being the only play he runs. You know, in Utah, a lot of his game was just high pick and roll, you know, high pick and roll, get a switch, run ISO. And he kind of had room to attack these guys with the space floor. And you just see none of that with this Cavs team. I think that it's probably been difficult to integrate him on the fly, some of the injuries. But, you know, I think that they could do a lot better for him in terms of putting him in positions to succeed, not just having him be a spot up guy. And so I think that part of it does fall on the organization. At the same point in time, he's a horrible defender. He can't guard anybody. And so I think that that really limits his ceiling regardless, because there's just no one to put him on. He can't stay in front of anyone right now. But, you know, from the Calderon Clarkson perspective, I think that by playing Calderon, your best hope is that he's just going to get you into some offensive sets on the offensive end. I mean, Clarkson, so many times he's coming down and he's just taking early shot clock jumpers that don't go in. And a lot of the times when LeBron is off the floor, I think your best asset is time. I think that you really want to milk the clock, grind it out, you know, play as few possessions in that time as possible. So even if the other team is outscoring you, you know, they're only going to have the ball for so often that it's not going to be a 9-3 run. It might be a 5-3 run. And what Clarkson does is he takes you out of those opportunities because he's just coming down. He's going into ISO and he's taking these early shots and they're all missing.
He's one of the least patient players I have ever seen.
And, you know, he's just not giving you the opportunity to kind of run through your offense and see what happens. And so I think that the upside of Calderon in that sense is just, you know, that he's going to get you into a set. You know that he's going to be patient and you might not get good offense out of it, but at least you're going to limit the opportunities for the opponent to kind of go the other way.
Yeah, I think that's why, like, Love needs to be on the floor then, because he gives you a hub. He gives you someone that, like, even if post-ups or elbow touches or whatever action you're going to run for him are not the sexiest things, not the most efficient things necessarily, you can count on it being good offense because he converts them when he's right at a good rate in the series. He's done a better job. It's not Thad Young defending him. It's these guys he can bully, especially if there's going to be the switching that you can create and milk those opportunities. As someone who, like, just really enjoys Jetty, I'm more intrigued by him than Calderon. And for terms of, like, what kind of basketball it could yield, because when you look at how Ty talked about Hood's defense, he talked about Hood not really botting up the bigger guy he's getting switched onto. Jetty's not, I'd have to look at their exact measurements, but when you see them in person, he's not exactly, Hood's a skinnier guy. Jetty at this point in his NBA career and in his adult life is not that much bigger than Hood. I think he's going to get bigger and stronger than Hood, and that's going to make him more valuable. But if you know one thing about him, it's that he's not really going to back down on the situations, and he's going to battle for defensive position. He's going to go for steals and he's going to foul guys. I think he'd get left alone a little bit in offense. He's definitely not a ball handler. There's going to be it limitations there. And I would wonder how a team like Toronto or a team like Boston that would have time to game plan would approach him as a rookie. But I think that I'm intrigued by what he would do and what he would offer them on the defensive end if they're going to keep switching and if Hood's going to be this bad. I wonder if it's just worth it just to see what happens for maybe 6 minutes of a half. And maybe game four is the time to do it, because even if it goes a little wonky, you're probably still going to win that game. And if you lose it, it's not as if you're too concerned about winning game five in Toronto.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I mean, it's kind of the same, you know, idea that Philly has with Markel Fultz going forward right now. I mean, you know, if you're Philly, you haven't really used Markel Fultz in this series, but game four is essentially the perfect opportunity to do it. You know, you're kind of, if you win, you know, you win, you're down 3-1 still. If you lose, you know, you're going to lose the series anyway. So the Cavs are essentially in the same spot there, where you might as well try to get Chetty some minutes, you know, kind of see what it's like. It won't be the highest of pressure situations, which I think is big. But I mean, we've really seen across the league, a lot of rookies have success in these playoffs. You know, some of them have struggled in certain games, but you know, even a guy like Ogilvy for Boston, I mean, he's come in and he's given them solid minutes, and yeah, there's no reason to think that Osman can't do the same for this Cavs team. And like you said, when you just look at Rodney Hood right now, I mean, he's not giving you anything defensively, and then he's not making up for it at all on the offensive end. He's not making threes. You know, he's dribbling the ball off his foot. And so it just doesn't seem to me like Hood has kind of earned the right to continue playing. And you might as well give Osman a look, because if he is good, you know, you better figure it out now. So when you go into the next series, you have more of a plan in place, and you just have some low pressure minutes that you can deal with right now. And you're not going to be throwing him into the fire by playing him in game four.
It's too early to fully discuss this, and I think it's something to be discussed come July, depending on what LeBron does. But when you look at how the new guys have factored into the playoffs, Hill aside, so you look at Nance Jr., you look at Hood, you look at Clarkson too. Well, Nance isn't playing right now. Those two guys are on the very fringe of the rotation and have not contributed anything. I think we obviously said the Cavs had to do the move. I think 10 times out of 10, you look at what they did at the deadline, you do that again. But when you look at how three of the four guys have played, does that change your perception of what the deal is for the Cavs in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to. You know, Hood and Clarkson have essentially been the two worst players in the playoffs, or two of the worst players in the playoffs. And I think it matters. And, you know, I tried to temper people's expectations about Clarkson when he was shooting 57% from mid-range, you know, early on in his tenure with the Cavs, and said, look, this isn't the guy that you're going to get. I mean, he has a lot of flaws, and Laker fans were happy to be rid of him for a reason. And, you know, when you look at, I mean, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison necessarily, but when you look at a guy like Nikola Mirotic, who was also traded for a first-round pick, and what he's done with the Pelicans in these playoffs, and, you know, you just wonder about the usage of your own first-round pick in a trade that yielded essentially two guys who have done absolutely nothing in these playoffs. And, you know, I think the Hood trade and the Hill trade are a little bit different, but when you look at that trade with L.A., obviously – it might have taken something to get Isaiah Thomas off the books, but you lose a guy in Channing Frye who could certainly be helpful again in these playoffs. You've seen the dearth of shooting that second unit is playing with, and a lot of times where the spacing has been hurt. I thought that was a big reason why Toronto was able to come back in game three. And, you know, you get two guys who one of them hasn't even played in the series, and the other one has been a huge negative, and it's just hard not to wonder, you know, what else could have been if you're using that first round pick.
This summer is just going to be nuts. I mean, from July 29th on, I am going to be very fascinated about Clarkson's and the salary number in particular, and his general fit are going to be some of the ways you can match money. Just throwing that out there. It's not as if he's attractive to a lot of other teams, but that salary number is interesting. Just in terms of pure cap space. Last thing, Mike, looking at game four, Cavs have a chance to sweep, would get some significant time off, which would be big for LeBron, big for everybody, particularly Hill and Love, the other two guys that are really important. What's something that you think the Cavs could do better, and what's something you think Toronto could do to adjust a little bit further from what went right for them or what went wrong for them in game three?
Yeah, I think from the Cavs' perspective, I mean, a lot of it just does come down to, you know, rotations in game three kind of turned a 15-point blowout into a game winner by LeBron. And I think that some of the rotations spurred some of the defensive issues. Kevin Love was stuck guarding OG Anunoby for entirely too long, and the Raptors were really able to take advantage of that by putting him in the pick and roll with Kyle Lowry. And I thought Lowry made some shots that were some pretty decent shots from him. But, you know, you really don't want Love to be in that position. I know that Lou talked about it after the game and said, you know, Kevin Love got switched out onto Lowry. But, you know, a lot of that was born because you were playing him next to Tristan Thompson for like 6 minutes of that fourth quarter. I thought that that was a bit too long for my taste. So I think shoring up some of the rotations will help. I thought Love was excellent defensively for the most part in the game. He was extremely good protecting the rim. I think that that's very encouraging. And, you know, you just have to expect the Raptors, from their perspective, to continue to come out and try to play incredibly physical. I'm sure that they thought that they found good success with that in the second half. You know, they were really, really leaning on Cavs players, pushing them around, holding, grabbing, a lot of the things that Indiana employed and had success with. And I think that that's somewhere that they're going to continue to be. It seemed like they found some success with that lineup down the end. You know, that involves CJ Miles, Lowry, Van Vliet, Ibaka, and Anunoby. You know, I don't know where that leaves DeRozan, but, you know, he wasn't very good in game three. I'm sure he'll be trying to gun to have a good game in game four. But the Cavs were targeting him defensively. He was slowing things down offensively for Toronto. So it'll be interesting to kind of see, you know, how quick Dwayne Casey's hook is on DeRozan and JV, who have both had excellent seasons for them, but, you know, have kind of been exploited for their specific matchup issues against the Cavs.
Yeah, I'm looking for that as well. I just want my thing with DeRozan is obviously he's had all these issues in the series, didn't play for the last 14 minutes or so of that game. If it's their potential last game of the season, I can't imagine it's going to run well with him to not be on the floor for when it really matters. I just wonder what that looks like if he's not. And for the Cavs, I just want to see if there are guys that we haven't seen in a rhythm yet. If there's someone that just hasn't played well yet, be it Rodney Hood, be it someone new that gets inserted, be it Jeff Green, who has had some good moments in the series. If there's things that just haven't quite worked, if they gel in this game and that gives them time to build on it going forward, be it in a game five or in the time off they're going to have to practice before the Eastern Conference Finals, I that's what I wonder. And I do think they would prefer to just get this done. I think they would, if this ends in four, I think the earliest they would play is like Sunday or something like that. Even if Boston sweeps this week as well, I think both teams would get time off. There would be a break, and I think the Cavs, based on what we know LeBron likes and what he's had to say, I think that's definitely what they would prefer. Mike, do you think they sweep on Monday?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's hard for me to think that the Raptors are going to come out, you know, with a lot of force if the Cavs make a run. I certainly believe that the Raptors will be playing quite hard from the tip, but, you know, one 15-5 run that didn't put them away in game three, you know, might be enough in game four to break their spirit. You know, there's just not a lot to be gained, I think, you know, of winning this game, having to go home to Toronto and, you know, having to do it all over again. So I think if the Cavs push hard early, you know, this one could get over pretty quickly.
That's what I'm looking for as well. Mike, thanks so much for hopping on a chat.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show. Again, find Mike on Twitter at ebzevgano11. Find me on Twitter at cwmwrites and on Facebook at cwmwrites. Find the pod on Twitter at LockedOnCavs and on Facebook at LockedOnCavs as well. Please go on iTunes, leave a 5-star rating interview to support the show. We'll be back tomorrow with a recap of Game 4, the Cavs' potential closeout game. Insight from the queue as I'm back in full action, no longer on a work trip. And again, support this podcast, share it, leave that 5-star rating interview, and thanks for listening.